Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 72 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Announcements this week. We had some new shots from the Outlander Stars Instagram account. We got another behind-the-scenes shot at, I think this is the first time she eats with them in the Great Hall.
It looks like they're arranged.
Yeah, Claire correctly. And Dougal and Colm and Letitia. All sitting at the table. That food looks so good. I can't even tell. Is that, they look like bagels. Are those bagels or is that fruit?
I can't see really well.
I don't think a bagel is appropriate for the time period. We also got, what would you call these? Like an Outlander meme? Kind of a meme?
I guess.
Kind of. Well, it's a shot of Murta with one of his quotes kind of emblazoned next to his face, and it says, "He needs a woman, not a lassie."
Speaking, of course, of Jamie.
Well, pretty much most men need that.
Yeah, but when he says he's talking about Jamie.
Of course. Now, I can't tell if this is a new shot or not, this next one.
It's a shot. I have heard people say it could be from Rent, but I think the reason it's not is because when they released something that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, the new teaser trailer, this is a still from that video, motion video. And so I don't think they would put clips from a previous episode in a preview teaser trailer for what's to come.
I think it's new because I have a pretty good recollection of her hair from episode to episode, and her hair's longer here. It's also completely down, which leads me to believe that this is not something we have already seen. Which was weird, because I remember in the last episode when they showed Claire with Blackjack in the... Was it Wentworth? Is that where they are? Or is it Fort William?
I think it's Fort William.
God, this is bad. Ignore me. Pretend I didn't just sound like I don't know what I'm doing. Her hair was significantly starting to look longer in that scene, at the end of that scene. Even from the beginning of the episode. So I don't know. Maybe it was just because it was damp and the weight of it was hanging down.
And remember, that could be...
A reshoot.
I don't think it was a reshoot. I think it was because of timing and... I think the last few minutes, I can't imagine a writer wouldn't write an entire episode. I believe the writer was the same, but the director was different. So we're getting, the content for it is much more harsh than a wedding night anyway, but we're getting harsher content and with harsher reality coupled with a new director for a little bit of that episode. And if that's the case, that could explain also the hair length.
Either way, I think this is a new shot from the trailer that we were released today. Well, before we get to that then. Stars released a new kind of, it's not really a trailer. I wouldn't call it a trailer. It's like a sneak peek kind of a thing, like a looking ahead.
What's to come? Stars Originals, yes.
Right. Which featured all of the Stars series. Mm-hmm. So it featured Black Sails,
Outlander, Power, and others.
Da Vinci's Demons?
I think Da Vinci's Demons, yeah.
Outlander, I thought, was featured pretty heavily.
Yeah, well, of course. And also, that's what we're going to see more easily.
I mean, I was looking for it. I'm not going to lie.
But I'm all for Black Sails, too. Oh, my goodness.
Okay. And on the 4th, which was just happens to be today, because they release a new thing for Droughtlander on the 4th of every month. So this month's Droughtlander offering was basically a teaser trailer hosted by Sam Heughan. So he basically introduces it and shows it's probably like the actual... Okay, the whole video is 59 seconds long. But I think that
like
the actual...
20 seconds
right,
of him.
Right. But even less than that is the trailer. Like, the trailer itself had to have been only, like, 15, 20 seconds. Like, it was blink and you miss it long. And then he talked... He capped it front and end with Sam Heughan-ness.
But it was nice to see kind of stuff that we hadn't... Well, not just obviously stuff we hadn't seen yet, because it's a new trailer. But scenes we hadn't seen yet. The line where she says... Or he says, "You want us to live apart or separate?" I mean, like, whew... You know what scene that's around in the book.
Right.
I mean, it's so nice to see different things. It's exciting.
I just think they could film every last one of Sam's scenes from here on out in front of that backdrop.
When he's, the mountains?
Yeah, the mountains?
The mountains.
Yes, the mountains. The beautiful mountains.
The
we call them mountains.
The valley.
There was also an article this week in Entertainment Weekly that was an interview of food stylist Lisa Heathcote, who... apparently does all of the food stylings for Downton Abbey and Outlander. So it's a pretty interesting read. If you have a minute, it's on Entertainment Weekly, and I'm sure we're linked to it. And lastly, Rolling Stone featured an article of the 25 hottest sex symbols of 2014, and our very own Katrina Balfe made the list. And now on to our read-along. This week, we are featuring Chapter 11 of Dragonfly and Amber, entitled Useful Occupations.
Chapter 10 ended with Jamie comforting Claire after her dream about Frank. Chapter 11 opens with the two of them in the main salon of the De Rouen's home, and a peculiar little man trying to make Jamie sing. Ellen G. writes, not only is Terry D. going to have fun with the French court, there are so many characters in this book that are so funny.
This was a good chapter, I thought, for me, because it was like nothing catastrophic was happening.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of the chapters when they're at Lallyrock, because it's kind of like that peaceful... I mean, yes, they are doing their whole subterfuge thing, and they're trying to, you know, thwart the whole uprising in general. However, that being said... nothing really horrible happens, and it's kind of nice to have a comedic chapter where, while they're still moving the plot forward, it's not gloom and doom, and Jamie's getting horrifically maimed.
That's always a good thing. Quote, with a resonating cavity like that, you should have a wonderful volume. Well, yes, monsieur, but one first must be able to match pitch.
That's true.
When Jamie does try to match the pitch of the tuning fork, the little man jerks back as though he'd been shot.
I love how disappointed he is. He's like, no.
He's like, this can't be.
No.
I had such hopes. And speaking from myself to Summer, I'm sure I've made that motion and face before when I hear someone try to sing.
You know,
or like, match pitch. Or
yes. And there will be no names named, but we had a gentleman in high school who was cast in a musical with us. Who literally was tone deaf to the point that when he sang, it sounded like he was trying to harmonize. Like, it was so...
I'm mouthing names to Summer and she's shaking her head at me. I want to know who this is.
I'll tell you later. My point
is awful.
Is that
maybe it's best that I don't know.
He was not a solo artist. He did not have a lead.
Solo
he did
artist.
Not. I'm just
like
saying,
we're solo
I'm
artists.
Saying he had no solo parts. He was not. It was a group.
I get it.
He was in the chorus.
A soloist.
They needed more men, so they let anyone in. And poor boy, he could not. Like
not
he
the
was
sandwich.
So no. He was so tone deaf. It sounded like he was attempting to harmonize. Like it was. He was that far off. It was so amazing to me.
But it wasn't so wrong that it was right.
Oh, no, it was not right. It was wrong. It was super wrong. But what I was going to say before I got into that was that when people sing, I never assume they're going to be good. I usually err on the side of thinking they're not going to be good.
That's funny.
And then when they're good, I'm like, oh, that was lovely and surprising, as opposed to the other way around.
So Summer and I both like musicals, and of course when you go to a professional production, you expect a certain quality of voice. It may not be every time you get it, you may not be listening to an Enjolras who's going to make you tingle in places.
It makes me think of a line from the musical City of Angels about there not being a dry seat in the house.
I didn't say tinkle.
I'm just saying, when there's a good singer, there's not a dry seat in the house.
Oh, is that a line? Really, truly?
Yes. But it's not about singing, but it's about something else.
Of course not, but it is about singing. Having a good singer, and
well,
then...
When I bring it up right now, it's about good singing. But in that musical, it's about somebody being so hot there was not a dry seat in the house.
Oh, they didn't say singing in the
it's
line?
It's not about singing, no.
But the line didn't use the word singing. Okay.
My point is, moving on from that.
That's good, though.
I find that I'm much more forgiving of male singers than female singers.
That's because you're female.
I know, but
female
singers...
Well, it's because you're singers, a female singer and a female...
I know. I just expect more from female singers. I expect them to be really good. And men, I'm a lot more forgiving with for whatever reason.
Well, and then you get to the phenomenon that we all... Anyone who's been, you know, raised in theater, done theater for ages, knows that, at least in certain levels, or at certain levels, it is much harder to find men, period, for roles... Forget good, really, really good men or boys, males, there are always more females for the female roles than there are for males for the male roles. And so you have, the population is automatically smaller, so that could play into being more forgiving. But even when you're at the level of someone who is a professional or semi-professional, and I tend to agree, I can still notice things, but I don't know if I'm much more, maybe I might have expectations like you do, like you just said, but as far as like if I had to write a critique of something, I would still notice something about every single type of singer. I wouldn't just listen to the women more. I don't think I'd listen to the women more critically than the men. Well, I would because I'm a female, and I notice things about my voice, and I'm, and also females have different types of voices, right? Like the whole, I mean, not that men, I guess, can't do it, but the whole pop mix, pop belt thing. I mean, you know, there's a, technically, I guess they're capable of it. But there's, you know, we don't have a falsetto. We have a head voice. And you know what I'm saying? There are certain things that you classify as a female voice things and male voice things. So yeah, because I've been through lots of voice training and you've been through lots of training in general for voice acting and different things, I think we have just been groomed more. And so it just, or at the very least, have been exposed to stuff. And so when we listen, it's been kind of ingrained in us to do this or not do that or look out for something to make us critical listeners, which I think is a good thing. And unfortunately, it ends up, I don't think we're bitches about it. No. I just think, I'll say it's very hard for me to enjoy things. Yeah,
it's hard for me not to have a critical ear. It's hard
and so for Summer me and I go to a show and we're sitting next to each other, which was, of course, we'd have to be sitting next to each
Don't
other.
Don't say we. This is you.
No, I haven't said, let me sit my sentence. If Summer and I attend a show or something and we are sitting next to each other while we're watching it, I
thank you.
Will, you know, even if it's totally going fine, going well, I usually will have my hand somewhere on the armrest or near her knee. It's just, I got to do it. Not because I
like a date or nothing. Your hand is not on my knee.
No, because not we went like to a show. But because there are, when singers are coming up, I usually will like put my hand near her or on her arm or something near her because I got to have that contact. Because as soon as something comes up that if we were not in polite company, didn't have to be quiet, I might let out a yelp or something, or say, oh, Lord have mercy. But we can't do that when you're an audience, right? You need to be polite and listen and allow other people to enjoy the performance to whatever amount they can. So what I do on parts or at times when something really funny happens or embarrassing, or you're listening to someone just like, that did not just come out of that mouth or whatever, like she did not just do that or he did not just do that, I will reach down and like squeeze the far out of her knee.
I or don't thigh. Enjoy it.
I don't think you enjoy it.
I try to discourage it.
You do what?
Discourage it.
Discourage?
Discourage.
Yeah, I heard discourage.
Well, then delete the 3 times you heard it wrong.
Just twice. So we love performing. We love watching performances. And I think it's good to be a critical listener. I think it's good. But it's also hard sometimes to enjoy things.
Oh, God.
Music. Yeah. The little man tries again. Jamie listened to the A. Tuning forks come in different pitches, but the most common one used in choirs for pitch match or interval attainment is A440, which is 440 hertz, which just the frequency hertz just means per second. So 1 over S, whatever over S.
Go get your pitchfork.
And so, yes, I do have a pitchfork. And I have a
pitch pipe.
A pitch pipe as well. So this, I do have, I don't, yeah, it is. I do, the pitchfork I have does say A440 on it. So let's see if I can hum it. I do have an A440 here. Hello. So that's an A440. We'll link to an article about pitch standards on Wikipedia. But basically, 440 is the current standard that was adopted by the U.S. and is used by much of, I guess, Western music. It is a world standard, but not the only standard used, but it's the most common one for A440 frequency for that note, and it's the A above middle C. It's a perfect fourth. The reason we know the little man did not ask Jamie to sing an A440 is because the 440 standard began in 20th century America. Technically, it's in the realm of possibility that the thing he had was a 440 just because it existed back then too. But it wasn't a standard back then, so the likelihood is it probably wasn't. There was a standard in the 19th century that was an Austrian standard, but again, wrong century, so we can't even say for sure that it's that. When you've talked about it, do you ever have to stop yourself from saying pitchfork?
Because I've sure said it like three times in this episode. I've said pitchfork instead of tuning fork. I know if you go back and re-listen, I said pitchfork
because I made a point. I want to ask you about that because technically it is a it's forked, mm-hmm. right?
Forked,
forked. Stop it. Technically, it is forked, but it's a tuning.
It's a tuning fork, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, sorry, tuning fork, but it also. It
provides pitch, so it could be a pitchfork.
And so it's hard for me not to say pitchfork. So
If you go back and listen, I said it two or three times.
Because I was just saying what you said.
Because we said pitchfork, and then I said pitch pipe, and then we just went
back. And when I say pitchfork, what do you think of?
Like the farming implement.
Yeah, but do you have one image in mind?
Jamie with the pitchfork.
Jamie in the hay, October 24th, 2013. You looked that up. No, I didn't. That was out of my head. I'm telling you, it's an image. It's emblazoned there.
Well, you attacked me in the kitchen that day.
I did know. Did I really?
Yeah, because the picture came out.
Was I crying? Like, did I just scream or was I crying? I didn't cry.
I don't think there was crying.
Just freaking out?
Probably.
Just, it was the first time for anyone seeing him in costume, right?
Yes.
Oh, that was crazy. Okay. Diana writes that Jamie produced a sound between E flat and D sharp.
Can you do that? Please don't. No, really.
No, it's not physically possible. You can get you can physically get a note between two adjacent notes because it's a quarter tone, and there's actually more than one. And, you know, it's maybe not infinite, but even if we can't hear the different increments, there are more increments than just a quarter tone. But a quarter tone is in between the half tones. And it's not possible, though, to get a tone between one note. One note is one note. But that was a great line by Diana. So since the two notes equal each other and E is a perfect fourth below A, this augments the fourth because it's a half step down from the perfect fourth. So it's an augmented fourth or a diminished fifth. And an augmented fourth or diminished fifth, both of those name for the same thing, another term for a tritone. Did you guys know about tritones?
Yeah.
Okay, tritones are also known as the devil's interval. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic that is the interval that Jamie sang. Naturally. Okay, to be fair, he didn't sing the interval. He sang one of the notes of the interval. But it's funny that that Jamie tried to match pitch and sang a tritone. So the little man says, "No one could be that dissonant even on purpose." And I think, have you ever tried to be dissonant and it just doesn't quite work? You're like, and I don't mean to be pretty. I mean to like make a joke or to actually sound bad. And it's not that you necessarily sound really, really good, but you can tell it's someone who has a good voice who's trying and not really succeeding. It's hard. It's sometimes hard to make it sound ugly. Other times I do just fine when I'm actually not trying to sound dissonant. Oh, yeah, you should have heard some of our takes on that Auld Lang.
Oh, Lord.
It was a trip and a half.
I mean, I don't want to toot our horn, but that took us like 45 minutes to
record. No, 25. Oh.
Meaning it took really long.
Well, it was fun, but it did take a little while. We're like, oh, no, we'll get this. Except you make it all the way to the end and then one mistake.
On one of any three things.
In voice. In harmony, in melody, in strumming, boom. You got to go back to the beginning. Then he faces Claire. We learn his name is Herr Johannes Gertzmann. Of course, the singing master would be German, or at least German-speaking. This was also the era of Maria Theresia. She was the last of the House of Habsburg just before Mozart was born. Okay, so this is just a few years into Maria Theresia's reign. She's the last of the House of Habsburg because then she marries, you know, obviously to produce children, you need to have male participation.
Interaction, I mean.
Yeah, I'm trying to say something that he gives you, but yes, interaction, participation. And so she married into the family, and since they, you know, only recognized the male line, but she was of the male line, after her, there were no more, quote-unquote, full-blooded Habsburgs. I mean, I guess it was she married another male from a different line, so then the line was, I think, called Habsburg-Lothringen. Anyway, so the reason I mention her is because in case he, Herr Gertzmann was Austrian, he may have spent some time at her court. You never know. And this is also just about 10 years, I think. Anyway, he was 36 or so when he died. So anyway, it would have been just a little bit of time before Mozart was born, because then Mozart's father was the Kapellmeister, I think, at a Kapellmeister in Vienna. These are some ideas of what else is going on just around this time. Maria Theresia acceded to the throne. She was the heir. She became the heir of the House of Habsburg, and that was in 1740, and she ruled till 1780. And she was also the mother of Marie Antoinette, who would be the wife of Louis XVI, right? So the little German, or Austrian, is looking for people to fill his impromptu chorus. And the man's wig was too big. That was a cute little picture to have in your mind. Ellen G. shares, "The choir master, Johannes Gertzmann's wig being too big, I can just see it. Better to keep Claire busy at these things, with participation in the choir, rather than an interlude in an alcove." So Claire is pulled by the music man further into the house. She sees the Princesse Louise de la Tour de Rouen again, and her description of her is rather sweet. "This is the woman who had ensnarled Prince Charles." Connie writes, "Louise figures fairly strongly in the portion of Dragonfly and Amber set in France as Claire's closest female friend, but fortunately is not as mysterious and possibly toxic as Claire's closest female friend at Castle Leoc, Gilles Duncan."
Well, agreed, 100%. But she brings her own issues to the table.
She seems a bit put out by Claire's full title and asks if she could just call her Lady Tourach, which I think is funny because wouldn't Lady Brock be easier?
Like, probably. Why? But she's French, so maybe Tourach is easier.
Who knows? It's just a whole lot fewer syllables.
Though she ends up just calling her Ma chère Claire.
That's true. Diana writes, "If she wanted to call me Lady North Facing, it was all right with me."
I don't know why that's funny.
Diana describes Louise's movements. Quote, "When she saw me, she dashed across the room as fast as her draperies would allow." That's more a comment of what she was wearing than of her plumpness, right? I mean, I think it's both.
To me, it was more of a comment on her dress, yeah.
We formally meet the, quote, "silly English child." Claire recognizes her from the party of English that had arrived just before she had fainted back at the palace. So Louise had brought them together because they were both English. It's interesting to see the type of woman that Charles is interested in. I wonder if that tells us anything of his character and later leadership ability. I guess we can't really comment on that right now. Yep. The little poppy girl stammered and shared her name, Mary Hawkins. And she says she doesn't sing. So this was the young girl who was going to be affianced to the Vicomte Marigny. Claire finds her in alcove and tells her to stay in if she wants, or come out if she wants to sing. Connie writes, "Claire encourages Mary to sing from the alcove, encouraging her that she may not stammer when she sings." Connie also shares, "People generally do not stutter when they sing, whisper, speak in chorus." I almost said speak in tongues, which I guess you wouldn't stammer. I mean, you never know. "Speak in chorus, or when they do not hear their own voice." So there is no universally accepted explanation for these phenomena.
No, but that very reminds interesting. Me of the King's Speech.
I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
Yeah, they had a whole thing about because
he's stammered.
Yeah.
Ellen G. writes, "Silly English child, Mary Hawkins, but Claire does send her into an alcove," which is interesting.
Right.
Then Claire gets a warning about the Comte Saint-Germain. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. She learns that he has spoken of her conversation partner, this time Madame de Ramage, one of the Queen's ladies, tells her that he's been telling people he believes her to be a witch. Other times, and maybe I think back in Le Havre was one time, but whenever there's been like even a whiff of a hint of something of Claire being considered something akin to a witch again, she doesn't shiver or shudder, but she internally at least freaks out because Claire, she at least in her mind.
It's a visceral goes, memory for
exactly,
her.
Exactly. She goes back to Cranesmere. I thought it was very interesting. After this woman literally said that this guy is saying you're a witch, Diana does not describe her mind as going back to Cranesmere. It's like one of the first times that there's been a literal mention of witch and Claire together in the same sentence, and we're not seeing her reacting and or at least it's not being described as her that she reacted with something akin to as she has previously to Cranesmere. If she did, then we didn't see it as readers.
So she was. It did state that she was already. She said, "I could feel myself flushing still more deeply, rattled by the appearance of the Saturnine Comte."
Yeah, but that
so
was
she was already rattled by it. So I don't think she could become more rattled.
Yeah, but I'm
by
saying,
it.
But I'm just surprised Diana
and that
didn't
was
mention
before the witch
word
thing was mentioned.
Yeah,
but then she didn't have a chance to because she said it and then like grabbed her and took her off. She says he's been going about telling people he believes you to be a witch. She said, smiling and waving at a friend across the room. A fine story. Oh, no one believes it. She assured me. Everyone knows that if it's anyone is mixed up in such matters, it's himself. And it was like pretty much she, Herr Gerstmann bustles in at that moment. So it was like she almost didn't have a chance to respond to it because almost immediately after saying it, Madame de Ramage is like, oh, no, of course no one believes it. We think that's ridiculous. So I think in this instance, perhaps, because it was dismissed so quickly, maybe it wasn't as big of an issue for Claire.
Maybe. I just thought that, again, that word witch, at least to me, on her behalf, it's a trigger for me. When I read it, I kind of figure, I think of Cranesmere right away. And I know she has, outside of the events of Cranesmere, when something has come up or there's been a hint of anything about her being a witch or her being, you know, otherworldly, she kind of, at least internally, freaks out a little bit or at least becomes a little hyper-aware. Ellen G. writes, warning against Comte Saint-Germain. Madame de Ramage telling Claire what has been said of her by him. A witch. Again, poor Claire can't help but get into it. Sorry, but I don't know who I'm with. I don't know who said this, or maybe it was just us that said this, but that whole, the Comte is not a good person, but Claire dug her own thing in Le Havre. I still don't, Le Havre was still, a lot of that's on her shoulders. As Jamie meets her after the singing, we see a side of him we don't often see. Shy, maybe slightly embarrassed, Claire points out a very small woman, Annalise de Marillac, and Jamie goes a little pink around the ears. We find out that he had fought his first and presently only duel over her when he was 18. He says that he's dead, the opponent, and Claire is shocked and says rather loudly, "You killed him?" Jamie takes her away from the crowds, presumably outside, since they were going toward a set of French doors. He hadn't killed him, though he'd wanted to. The man actually had died of a sore throat 2 years past. So yes, they are outdoors. They're in the garden now, walking around the pass by the reflecting pool.
But what I liked about the whole discussion of the duel was that the gentleman that he challenged to the duel was obviously, I took him to be an older gentleman than Jamie, and treated him with such kid gloves about the whole manner. Like, he was like, I don't want to, like, bruise him. He's just a little kid. It's a kid's, like, fascination, like
a
crush.
So that could be part of the reason that he didn't choose pistols.
Right, that's why he's like, I don't want him to accidentally kill me.
Yeah, but he's also, like, an expert in these other little...
He's like, I don't want him to accidentally... He's like, the odds of him killing me with this sword are much slimmer because I'm good with it. If I pick pistols, he might accidentally actually hurt me. Mm-hmm. However, if he draws a little blood with a sword, I'll survive that, and it'll actually work out better for me because
I'll get sympathy.
She obviously already likes me more than him, and he's like, it's just a little kid's fascination and infatuation with her. So I think he was kind of, it almost felt like he was treating Jamie with kind of kid gloves, where he's like,
just
kind of
sweet,
I'm gonna let you win this duel. And I may totally be reading into that, but that's totally how I felt about it.
I like that. I think it's interesting. So they are outdoors. They're in the garden now, walking around the paths by the reflecting pool. Diana describes the dolphin spraying water, quote, over an annoyed-looking triton in the center, who brandished a trident rather ineffectually at them. Jamie seems not really annoyed, but he is resigned, and he tells her about the duel. Jamie and others had it bad for the petite Annalise. He didn't eat. He went about in a daze. Jamie didn't like that she chose Charles Gauloise so often for her dinner partner or dance partner. But the final straw was when he saw them kissing on her father's terrace. He challenged him, and Dueling was illegal at the time, as it was at this time in Paris. But there were always places, he says. He mentions the Bois de Boulogne. Now, I'm...
Not Boulogne?
Nope, there's no accent on the end.
Accent?
Yes.
Even that was French.
Hey, when you learn French, that you learn what to say, accent aigu, accent grave. Charles chose swords, to Jamie's surprise. We learn that Jamie and Murta stayed in practice. This is now, current day. Jamie and Murta stayed in practice with their swords by parrying with each other every few days. Anyway, Jamie didn't mean to kill him, just to humiliate him. And I just had a thought. This tale, the tale of the duel, is being told while they're at the edge of the pool, right? Water is spraying, Claire is being misted by the fountain. And though this is not a vision like Roger and Galus and Claire have had around or in water, this is a memory and something that is being described and pictured. So there is a visual being invoked in the presence of water. Do you think... What do you think?
Mm-mm. No, because he's physically telling her the story.
Ellen G. writes, and again, Claymy...
Claymy? No.
Oh, Lord. Ellen G. shares, as they fought, Jamie's hair... During the duel, Jamie's hair had come out of its tie and gotten in his face, which made it hard for him to see the other man. Now, Jamie was pretty happy that he had wounded him. He says that after all of his training, because his hair got in his eyes and the small size of Charles, he dagged him, quote, the way you spear a fish with the dirk. So he basically, training out the window, or maybe because of his training, but the hair in the way, the guy was small, he did exactly what he could, which was, you know, basically not a pretty thing, but he just stabbed at him. Now, we don't want to give anything away later in this book. No. But in relation to a comment Mandy made, we'll say this. Remember Jamie's hair getting in his face. Connie shares, Claire learns of Jamie's duel at age 18, and we get some clues / foreshadowings from that duel that lead to great consequences later in this book. Another thought. The telling of the truth also happens by streams and burns. Another water source. So perhaps visions, retelling stories, visiting the past, or telling the truth, whatever, in general? Is that?
Well, if this were Hemingway and it were raining, I would say that someone's going to die.
That's true.
But I don't know that that is a Diana Gabaldone.
No. The one thing I do think that we've found, even though I haven't heard her confirm anything, because I never heard anyone ask her that, was the Galus in water and Claire in water, that's a given. That's in book one.
Yeah.
The Roger in water is not a given, but it's a huge likelihood, or at least a good possibility. At least the Roger is a great possibility because it was a vision he had and he was in water. This and that hadn't happened. This is a retelling of a past event, which makes it different. Annalise, of course, threw herself on Charles and then married him a month later. Jamie's heart was broken, and he returned to Scotland, where he moped about. He says he even thought of, quote, turning monk over it. That would be a funny sight. He told his father, and his father's reaction, to put the spoon down, sigh, shake his head, and say, it's been a long day, Jamie.
He has more patience with his children than I do.
Oh, my... Yeah.
Good Lord, if... My daughter came at me with something ridiculous like that at the end of a long day. I don't know that I'd be able to just patiently say, it's been a long day. You need to just...
Jamie fondly remembers Annalise as graceful and, quote, so small that you wanted to tuck her inside your shirt and carry her like a kitten. Claire became thoughtful and contemplating her foot size. Connie writes, Claire is not thrilled with Jamie's description of Annalise. And Connie... The foreshadowing you mentioned about a later book. Yes, I thought of this too. I don't want to say anything. I wanted to acknowledge what she gave us, but I don't want to say what it was, which I know that's not really fair, but it was, yes, I got the image after that line as well. He tells her, graceful is possibly not the first word that springs to mind at the thought of you, but I talk to you as I talk to my own soul. And then he says, of course, and Sassenach, your face is my heart. Another very iconic line from the series. As the scene ends, they are sprayed by water from the fountain as the wind shifted. Loved the framing of this scene with water on either side of it. The next evening, Claire tells Jamie about our conversation earlier that day with Herr Gertzmann, who suggested she might meet a friend of his, Mother Hildegard, at L'Hôpital des Anges. Jamie wasn't happy about the idea. Ellen G. writes, "So the loose-wigged singing master introduces Claire to Mother Hildegard? Well, I think he introduces her to the name. I mean, I don't know if he's there physically when they meet, because I think Claire just goes and meets her, right? Mm-hmm. Later on, which isn't really a big
spoiler. He introduces her to the hospital, for sure.
Yeah, but he's not present there when he's...
She kind of goes on her own. It's almost like he introduces her name.
He's like the liaison or something, but he's not its like existence. Here, but
use my name as a calling card to get in the door.
So Jamie is not happy about the idea of Claire going to the hospital, a woman of her standing, but also her being a nurse. She tells him that she's going to the hospital the next day. She would like to work there regularly. Jamie's not happy about her going or working there. He reminds her that she's pregnant and is seemingly appalled that she would want to go, quote, out to nurse beggars and criminals. Her mind goes to concealing her pregnancy, and she says that she's not showing yet. While he points out that she is his wife, she points out that she is a healer. It is very interesting to see this side of Jamie. We've seen him protective of her and, of course, the child. It's understandable. But to imply that beggars, criminals, prostitutes, etc. aren't worthy of her care, it definitely doesn't seem to be very King of Men. Of course, the era they are in, I understand, is different than the one she comes from and our current era. It's just good to see some very human emotion from and imperfection in Jamie.
Well, let's think about it, though. The era that Claire comes from, where she started nursing, was in a war setting where everyone is kind of made equal by the state of the world being at war. Whereas in 1740s France, the specific hospital she's wanting to visit is where the people who can't afford doctors basically go to die. Mm. And they usually bring with them really horrific things that most people would catch and also die from. So he's right to be concerned, also because of the mission that they're on for her to be seen in the company of beggars and prostitutes probably would not do well for their mission.
And he didn't even bring that up.
He didn't, but I'm sure it was in the back of his mind.
I just think it's a very interesting juxtaposition against Jamie the Christ figure of book one. Christ would he fed too, but Christ would, you know, be there for... He says, quote, "the kind," meaning the kind of woman, "the kind who would abandon her husband to go and play with the scum in the gutter." Very strong, ugly language used by our hero. This conversation is very interesting and reminds us of their being from very different worlds. Jamie admires Claire's abilities and wanting to help people, but has a very hard time imagining her doing it as his wife and as the mother of his child, and specifically at that place. His reaction isn't really that surprising as an 18th century male. And the reason I say it's not just the fact that it would be with, quote, the people from the gutter, it's he also brings up specifically, is it not enough to be my wife? Is it not enough to do this? Is it not enough to be in the house and do this? And she's like, what? No, it's really not. I'm not good at it. Our servants do it better than me. They almost are saying the exact same things. Well, I'll get to that in a second. So it's a very interesting conversation they had. But his reaction isn't, not that I've met a few or anything, but his reaction isn't really that surprising as an 18th century male. So Ellen G. writes, abandonment? She wants out of the salon life. I don't think Claire would have been a stay-at-home mom or stay-at-home wife in the 40s either. She would have either found work as a nurse or something else. What do you think?
I think that I have a lot of strong opinions about that echo back to what happens in book 3. So I don't feel comfortable discussing, because we all know exactly what kind of a wife she was in the 1940s.
Connie writes, and this is all caps, "This is an extremely important discussion that affects Jamie and Claire's relationship and understanding of each other going forward throughout the series." Very true. We learn about Jamie's frustrations with Jacobite politics, letters, and correspondence. He feels useful about the wine and spirits business, able to deal with that, but the politics are frustrating to him. And that actually made me think of something else too. Yes, to use your words, Connie, he feels useful in certain things. I like that you use that word. So this is very interesting. He can feel useful, meaning helpful. He has a purpose. He is doing something in the wine and spirits business, and that and can have a frustration that things are so much more difficult or more frustrating in politics. Yet he can't see how she feels useless sitting around in parlors, at parties, etc. Although she never complained about the parties. She says, I know that we need to do this for our job here, but they don't take all day or all night. She has, just as he does, she has a purpose. Other than their purpose there together, she has a purpose too, which she's had since before they met. And he acknowledges it. But Connie is very right. This discussion, this entire thing, it is kind of laid to rest, I guess, in the next book or two or something. But as far as their relationship and her working as a healer in other places, in other hospitals, whatever it may be, to help other people outside of the home, 100%. It's not even really, he may have an opinion like, oh, I wish you would be home more or do whatever, but it's never an issue like it is right here. After this, or at least after this book, it does not become this again. Correct? They are, I'm not saying this discussion, but after this whole thing with L'Hôpital des Anges, and after her doing what she's going to do, after this book, in later books, there is never such a huge thing about her working
there's not, to help people. But we also, and by we, I mean you, also have to recognize the fact that in later books, a lot happens away from each other,
yes,
and then back together, which, you know, we know happens because she's in the 60s in the beginning, yes, with Brianna. So a lot of time is spent apart, and in that time apart, they became separate people. And mm-hmm, each person moved forward in their lives and became mm-hmm
more of it, whatever they were.
Right. So, of course, it doesn't come up again in the series to this degree because they're different people, I think.
I'm also very touched by his use of the word abandon. He thinks it's akin to abandonment, and she feels that she's useless. She says, I don't notice you hanging around the house all day adoring me. And as for the household, bosh. And then Jamie demands, bosh, what's bosh? And then she explains it. And it's very like them, and it's very Diana with them. To have this very serious or very highly emotional discussion or argument or something, and then to have this term come out and have him ask about it and say, basically, what the F does this mean?
It's a tension breaker.
No, it totally. And it just makes the reader laugh. And I could only imagine makes her kind of want to laugh, too. They're still both upset. And she explains what it is. And it is very funny in the middle of all this tension. He says, and if I forbid you to go? She replies, do you forbid me? And this reminds me of the duel he described earlier. Is this not another duel? Words are like weapons. They wound sometimes. It is a duel. They're having their own duel. In their fight, Jamie is running his hands through his hair. Quote, the lacing around his hair broke under the stress, and the thick locks fluffed out like a flaming halo. Mandy pointed this out to us, too. Another mention of his lace breaking, his hair flowing wildly over. This is more foreshadowing. It's definitely a standoff. As a matter of fact, Claire's mind races to, quote, planting the ivory letter opener between his ribs. Isn't that a bit like a dirk stabbing a fish? He lightens up a bit and does not forbid her, but asks, but if I asked you? Now that's our Jamie. He's frustrated and touchy at the moment because he doesn't feel he's getting anywhere with Charles. He doesn't know if he's making progress, even doing all that he is. She reminds him that they are doing it together, and that all they can do is try. She asks him to think about the hospital, too, to think about the situation, and then they go to bed.
It makes me wish that she'd had one of those Back to the Future history books that constantly changed as they made adjustments to the timeline.
To see if they had any effect?
Mm-hmm. It'd be so much easier.
In bed the next morning, Jamie is putting out British thermal units. In other words, he's like a furnace. Gracious. They feel around, not the thermal units, but their hands. They both feel around her uterine area, and he feels the slight Summer's forehead just, like, wrinkled in concern. He feels the slight bulge of the womb baby.
The womb baby?
Well, there's no other kind of baby. Baby in the womb, is that better? He suggests womb the name.
Baby. Where else would it be? Honestly.
He suggests the name Dalhousie.
I have no idea. Every time I read that, I'm like, what?
Dalhousie. And, yeah, and other names are brought up, including naming him as if it's going to be a boy.
Naming him?
Naming him after Uncle Lamb, her uncle, and after her father, Henry Montmorency Beecham. William for his older brother who had died. And so far out of all those, I would say William. Then the name James comes out through the flue of the chimney several times. It is Prince Charles in disguise, jumping on rooftops and climbing in their window.
Every time you say Prince Charles, I think we're talking about
the Prince Charles. Yeah, no.
Like in England.
Jamie helps him in and then shields him from Claire's view since his trousers are undone.
And she's pretty much naked in bed.
He's also wounded. Claire, ever the healer, gets out of bed to look at the wound. We learn it's a monkey bite. Claire says he's likely fine, unless it's a rabbit. And the prince, though he has no idea what it means, gets really worried and said, he still goes pale at the thought. All right, Summer, have you had your rabies vax?
No.
I have.
Because most human beings don't need it.
I know. Most human beings don't like to play with bats.
Or monkeys.
Oh, no, I never play with monkeys.
Or squirrels.
I pet squirrels. I don't play with them, but... Jamie takes Charles downstairs to get him a drink, and Claire goes back to sleep, pondering the prince. Jamie wakes her up sometime later with his ice-cold feet behind her knees, making her scream. We learn that Charles Stuart was visiting his mistress, who just happens to be Louise Latour. They had fought over her pet monkey, and he'd threatened to leave her forever. But then truly had to escape out the window when they learned Louise's husband had returned earlier than planned. Then he hopped along rooftops to Jared's house, where he was helped by Jamie. He also took one of their horses to ride back to where he was staying. Now, Jamie very much did not approve of the whole mistress thing, especially since it was with a married woman. And when curling up with Claire in their bed, Diana writes, "Well, it will be a cold, wet journey, no doubt," said Jamie, with the smugness of a man virtuously tucked up in a warm bed with his lawfully wedded wife. Then they spooned. "Serve him right," he muttered. "A man ought to be married." Jamie's definitely got some opinions. He's quite the conservative in this relationship. Mandy comments, "Jamie is usually so enlightened that I find it hilarious when he descends into outraged propriety. And the muttering in Gaelic just gives me such mental images." The next day, Claire goes to visit with Louise. Then she returned home in the late afternoon. When Jamie sees her, he goes to her. The next day, Claire goes to visit with Louise. Then she returns home in the late afternoon. When Jamie sees her, he goes to her and buries his face in her hair and then sneezes. She tells him she smells like jasmine, roses, hyacinth, and lily of the valley. And maybe even ragweed, apparently, since he's allergic to something. But we find out it's hyacinth. When he finishes sneezing, he finds her beginning to undress. She's covered in oil of hyacinth. She says, "If I don't wash it off, you're liable to explode." As she reaches up to put her hair in a bun so she can clean herself, Jamie demands, "What have you done, Sassenach?" staring at her underarm. She'd waxed it. She explains the process. The scented beeswax, heated, spread, cooled, and then jerked off. And Bob's your uncle.
Freezing.
Jamie replies, "My Uncle Bob wouldn't countenance any such goings-on. What in the hell would you do that for?" She says it hurt a bit, but it's worth it. It's the first time she's felt clean in months. Jamie doesn't see the connection between clean and hair in your oxters. She explains that it smells much less. "And what's wrong with the way you smell? At least you smell like a woman, not a damn flower garden. What do you think I am, a man or a bumblebee?" She says that she did her legs, too. She says it could have been worse. That her friend had all her body hair removed. Jamie's reply is wonderful. "What? She's taken the hairs off her honeypot?" he said, horrified into uncharacteristic vulgarity. "Merry Michael and Bride," he says. "She's going about now bare as a wee lassie." Claire replies that Louise says that men find it erotic. Diana writes, "His eyebrows nearly met his hairline. A neat trick for someone with such a classically high brow." So Ellen writes, and that Jamie reacted to a 20th century saying by throwing it back into Claire's face, Uncle Bob, Oxter's legs, but not on her honeypot. That really shut Jamie up, and this whole incident made it easier, I think, for Claire to go to the hospital later on, as she would get into less trouble that way. Was this planned, or was Claire just so happy to be waxed, as I'm sure she might have been in the 20th century? A reminder of where she had come from. So when she was there, were her thoughts, oh goody, I get to be waxed? Or were they, if I do this and Jamie reacts badly to it, might it be easier for me to get to go to the hospital without another spat from Jamie? I thought, that is very interesting.
My thought on that subject is that I think that Claire is a very smart woman, but I don't think of her as being that calculating, you know what I mean? To that degree. Like, that was like some straight-up spy.
Beep. Like a Frank?
Yeah.
I think it was probably a happy accident.
But it was obviously convenient for everyone concerned. Yes. And I'm pretty sure Jamie grew to love it.
The results.
I'm just saying the results.
Of her arms or legs?
I don't know.
Connie calls this section, quote, wax on, wax off, no Mr. Miyagi involved. Connie writes, we get a very humorous description in which Claire explains shaving and waxing to Jamie. Jamie's line, what do you think I am, a man or a bumblebee? And that's two bumblebee references in one chapter. And she's right. The first one was from the description of how Herr Gertzmann was humming in Claire's ear. Connie continues, Jamie is very shocked when Claire tells him that Louise had all her body hair removed. And then she says, now we could, but I don't suggest we do, have a discussion of the many alternate names of women's genitalia, but I'm not going there. And so I wrote, thank you, Connie. We definitely don't need to go there again, even though it would be tit for tat. And that's chapter 11.
She says that to rush me through because I was literally sitting there going, maybe I should Google it.
No, I think...
But then I was thinking to myself...
The women's are almost more foul than the men's.
That's what I was thinking. Like, the men's are comical, but women's, like the... Not women... First of all, women really don't name their junk. That's just a, that's just a given.
I don't like it called junk.
I know, but it's usually other, like, men naming women's junk, calling it other things, and most of them are not, they're not funny, they're, most of them are just really crass,
yeah,
or, like, really moderately grotesque, to the degree that it's not super funny, so, I don't know, maybe I'll look it up tomorrow, and I'll see if I change my mind, but where I stand right now, I think we're good. And that is chapter 11. Come back next week. I think we'll be doing chapter 12.
L'Hôpital des Anges.
I can't even pretend to.
There's no S in there.
L'Hôpital.
Uh-huh.
L'Hôpital des Anges.
Elysian. Des Anges.
Des Anges.
Mm-hmm.
L'Hôpital des Anges.
Des Anges.
I am not good at this.
You did it, except you didn't put it together.
L'Hôpital des Anges.
There you go.
Woohoo! Chapter 12, L'Hôpital des Anges. Come back. Let's do this.
Thank you so much for joining us. Again, Happy New Year. Happy 2015, Year of the Sheep. No?
I mean, it's very appropriate for Scotland.
I know. I
just didn't realize
it
was Year of the Sheep.
Happy New Year. Thank you so much. No. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night.